This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Imagination. I'm borrowing the title of a book that he wrote about his conversion, and if you don't already know why it's called Surprised by Joy, you will learn something about that as we do, as we go through this talk. I've bitten off a rather large topic, and I'm going to try to cover a lot of things in enough detail that it'll at least spark your thinking and spur you to think some more and read some more. A lot of good things are being written on this. I want to begin with a poem, and this poem is by C.S. Lewis, and hello. How do I make it go? Oh, I do it there. Not very, not very good. Okay, it's not very big. That's why it's good you have it in front of you, and also it couldn't all fit on the same page, so you can look at this. So Lewis wrote this poem called The Country of the Blind, and it gives us a really vivid picture of the problem faced in practicing apologetics in the modern world. Hard light bathed them, a whole nation of eyeless men. Dark bipeds not aware how they were maimed. A long process, clearly a slow curse, drained through centuries, left them thus. At some transitional stage then, a luckless few, no doubt, must have had eyes after the up-to-date, normal type, had achieved snug darkness, safe from the guns of heaven, whose blind mouths would abuse words that belonged to their great-grandsires, unabashed, talking of light in some unit, etiolated, fungoid sense, as a symbol of abstract thoughts. If a man, one that had eyes, a poor misfit, spoke of the gray dawn or the stars or green-sloped sea waves or admired how warm tints change in lady's cheek, none complained he had used words from an alien tongue. None questioned. It was worse. All would agree. Of course, came their answer. We've all felt just like that. They were wrong, and he knew too much to be clear, could not explain. The words, sold, raped, flung to the dogs, could now avail no more, hence silence. But the mold warps with glib confidence, easily, oops, sorry, we're now on to another slide here. But the mold warps with glib confidence easily showed how tricks of the phrase, sheer metaphors, could set fools concocting a myth, taking the word for things. Do you think this a far-fetched picture? Go then, about among men now famous. Attempt speech on the truths that once opaque, carved in divine forms, irremovable, dread but dear as mountain mass, stood plain to the inward eye. As I say, a vivid picture of the problem faced in practicing apologetics among people who are blind, trying to talk about things, help people see things, but they can't see them because they're blind. And I want to just point out a few things. I am hopeless at this stuff. Now what do I do? So these eyeless men, notice, in spite of being bathed in part light, deny the existence of light. They're described, notice, in the second stanza as up-to-date normal type. Moderns who've kept up with the times. They see their state as normal, not abnormal. And then I love the line later down here. They've achieved snug darkness, safe from the guns of heaven. What a description. What are the guns of heaven? We're going to be talking some about the guns of heaven. Glimpses or hints of glory which speak to the existence of an invisible reality or a reality beyond this world. I think that's what the guns of heaven is a reference to. They still use the word light to mean what? Merely symbolic for some abstract idea or understanding. Their response to the abnormal man, the misfit, who can see and speaks of the various effects of light in the material world, we've all felt like that. They treat what he says as a way of describing subjective sensations, his own personal opinion. Notice, he knew too much to be clear. He knew too much to be clear. He was silenced because words, sold, raped, flung to the dogs, had lost their meaning as references to objective reality. And what's the position of the blind? They believe that taking words as names for things has led to the concoction of all kinds of misleading myths, i.e. falsehoods, religion. And then this last stanza. Go then among them, men now famous. Attempt speech on the truths that once opaque, carved in divine forms, irremovable, dread but dear as mountain mass, stood plain to the inward eye. Words have lost the meanings that they once had. They are no longer able to reliably convey truth to the inward eye. And this is the task, then, of the apologist, is to find a way to reach these blind, eyeless people. But let's back up for a moment. What is apologetics and what is it good for? Apologetics is commonly understood as a reasoned defense of the faith, or as Lewis says, a defense of the truth of Christianity. Apologia is Greek for defense or argument for a position. And the biblical basis for this is in the book of 1 Peter, where Peter is writing a letter to a church in the midst of a pagan society, talking to them about the fact that they need to expect to be persecuted for what they believe. But in the third chapter, he says to these people, do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. So, in a sense, this is what apologetics is. It is giving an answer. Be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks for a reason for the hope that you have. It implies that someone has seen something they would like to have explained. Something has prompted a question. And again, the context for this, the context is the fact that they're to expect suffering, abuse, slander for their beliefs. But when these Christians don't respond in kind, some will want to know why. What do you have which makes you imperturbable? Your hope for something you can't lose. And Peter has already given a very broad statement in the first chapter of the letter about this hope. In the first chapter, third and fourth verses, he says, "In his great mercy, God has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade." So the dilemma is, how do we talk about this to people for whom these words are meaningless? They'll ask the question, but how do we communicate? I want to give you an image which I think can help us understand the work of the apologist. First of all, think about Jesus' parable of the sower, which is in several of the Gospels, one of them in Mark 4. And remember that there's a farmer who goes out to sow seed. And he sows the seed, and some of it falls on hard ground, some on rocky ground, some amid thistles, and some falls on good ground, on good soil. And only that seed, which falls on the good soil, grows, sprouts. Jesus explains to his disciples that the seed is the word, and that only the seed sown in good soil grows, or, as it says, hears the word, accepts it, and becomes productive. Now, I don't want to be sacrilegious, but I want to introduce another character into this parable to help us understand something. Let's introduce an assistant to the farmer. And his job is to go out and prepare the soil for the seed. Get rid of those rocks. Plow up that hard ground. Get it so that when the seed falls in it, there's more good soil where the seed will grow. This is the work of an apologist, someone who prepares the soil so that the seed can grow. The goal of an apologist is therefore a limited goal. And we see this again when Paul picks up this image in 1 Corinthians 3 about being fellow laborers with Christ and sowing. Some sow, some water. They have different jobs to do. And he talks about God's fellow workers playing different roles in this metaphor. But the key phrase is, but only God makes things grow. The apologist does not create belief. The apologist is the one who prepares the soil so that the word can be planted and then can grow. I want to read from a book that I discovered after I had picked this topic called Apologetics and the Christian Imagination, an integrated approach to defending the faith by a woman named Holly Ordway, who came to Christianity through atheism. She's writing about what she's calling imaginative apologetics. And she talks about it like this. First of all, she quotes a theologian who was a friend of Lewis's. As Austin Ferrer explains, the work of apologetics does not stand on its own, but rather cultivates an environment in which belief can develop. Though argument does not create conviction, the lack of it destroys belief. What seems to be proved may not be embraced, but what no one shows the ability to defend is quickly abandoned. Rational argument does not create belief, but it maintains a climate in which belief may flourish. I would add to Ferrer's point in this way. We need, above all, to cultivate an environment in which belief is both reasonable and meaningful. And that's kind of the working definition that I want to use for what we're going to talk about. Cultivate an environment in which belief is both reasonable and meaningful. Now, I want to just put in a little bit of a comment at this point that's not always cut and dried to distinguish between the work of the apologist and the work of the evangelist. The line between these two is not always clear. If you look at the lists of gifts given to the church in the letters in the New Testament, you'll see pastor, evangelist, apostle, prophet, administrator even. You don't see apologist there. I think it's a very helpful thing to talk about, that something needs to prepare the person to make sense of the word that's being spoken, the truth that's being spoken, the truth of Christianity that's coming to them. But as I say, the line between the two is not always clear, and we'll see that as we go along here. When actually is the seed planted? We don't always know. We don't know if the person we've talked to has heard the gospel earlier in their lives sometime. We don't know what other conversations they've had. We don't really know where they are in this process. But they may be skeptical and have questions that they want answers to. I think we can do well to remember Jesus' words to Nicodemus concerning the work of the Spirit. Jesus, of course, could see into people's hearts, so he knew exactly where they were and exactly how to approach them and how much to say. Nicodemus is one of the few people who is really ready, and he gets more propositional truth than hardly anybody else in the Gospels, if you just look at those that chapter 3 of John. But what does Jesus say to Nicodemus about the work of the Spirit? He says, paraphrasing, it's like trying to see the wind. We can't see the wind. We can only see its effects. So there's something a bit nebulous sometimes about where a person is in the process. And when we're doing the work of apologetics, we may be doing some evangelism as well. So let's talk next about removing the rocks, or actually doing the work of apologetics in preparing the soil by removing the rocks. The seed, that is the truth, remains the same, but the nature of the rocks, or the obstacles to belief, changes in different times and in different places. And the apologist, above all, needs to understand his or her audience and meet them where they are. And different periods of time, you're dealing with different things, different obstacles, different rocks are in the soil that you need to overcome. Lewis talks about one of the rocks, which is just kind of, and that would be because, we gotta go back one. We'll get there in a minute. Oops. Oh, no. This is very sensitive, and I'm not used to the touching method. There we go. So one of the rocks that we need to take into account in our day is, and it was true in Lewis's day, and he talked about this as well, is the materialist or naturalist view, which is taken for granted by moderns. We need to make the idea of the supernatural meaningful to people. They basically believe in the material world and what they can see and what they can test, what science can show them. How do we make the idea of the supernatural meaningful? Lewis wrote an essay on Christian apologetics. Actually, it wasn't an essay. It was a talk that he gave to a group of pastors at one point about Christian apologetics. And in it, he talks a bit about this, where he says, the difficulty we are up against is this. We can make people often attend to the Christian point of view for half an hour or so. I'm not sure that's still true. But the moment they have gone away from our lecture or laid down our article, they are plunged back into a world where the opposite position is taken for granted. As long as that situation exists, widespread success is simply impossible. We must attack the enemy's line of communication. What we want is not more little books about Christianity, but more little books by Christians on other subjects with their Christianity latent. It is not the books written in direct defense of materialism that make the modern man a materialist. It is the materialistic assumptions in all the other books. In the same way, it is not the books on Christianity that will really trouble him. But he would be troubled if, whenever he wanted a cheap popular introduction to some science, the best work on the market was always by a Christian. And so he's saying, this is kind of, some people would call this pre-apologetics, but it really is, because what the task has become in our day, it's a long-term project that involves changing people's vision of reality, making at least another vision of reality meaningful to people. And one way to do that is to make it be true about all kinds of things. Now, he also talks in the same essay about how the language that we use can be an obstacle to belief unless we are able to, quote, present timeless truths in the language of our own age. Just as missionaries to China must learn Chinese, we need to, quote, learn the language of modern infidels, who are our neighbors, our fellow countrymen, in order to reach them. Part of learning to translate theological language, part of this is learning to translate theological language into the vernacular without watering it down, Lewis says. And in giving this talk to these ministers, he actually gave them a little glossary of words that he said, don't assume that people mean the same thing that you do by these words. I'm just going to pick one of them, the word personal. He said, I had argued for at least 10 minutes with a man about the existence of a personal devil before I discovered that personal meant to him corporeal, being in a body. I suspect this of being widespread. When they say they don't believe in a personal God, they may often mean only that they are not anthropomorphists. They don't see God as a grandfather with a long beard sitting on a throne in heaven. And then he goes on to say this, you must translate every bit of your theology into the vernacular. This is very troublesome, and it means you can say very little in half an hour. But it is essential. It is also the greatest service to your own thought. I have come to the conviction that if you cannot translate your thoughts into uneducated language, then your thoughts were confused. Power to translate is the test of having really understood one's own meaning. So this idea of translating into the vernacular and speaking language that's meaningful to people. Lewis, of course, was a master at doing this, and it's why his books are still so popular and were popular at the time. It's also why he lost respect from most of his fellow professors who basically considered him a popularist, and he never got, he was never given a professorship at Oxford University because of this. I think Francis Schaeffer was also really, really good at speaking to the people of the time that he was living in, of translating to the stream of skeptics who came through Le Brie in the 60s and 70s, talking about Christianity as the reality about everything. It's the reality of everything around us, and using language that wasn't theological language, but using other ways of explaining that and talking about that to people. So this project of translation is only becoming harder and more important over the last few decades. Words which were commonly understood by both believers and unbelievers in earlier times now have different meanings depending on one's point of view. One of my very first Le Brie lectures years ago was called Love in the Context of Truth. It was just dawning on me that the word love meant one thing to a relativist and another thing to somebody who actually believed in absolute truth. To the relativist, love means tolerance, acceptance. Just accept a person no matter what they say, what they think, what they do with their lives. Whereas for a Christian, love has a different definition, because to love somebody, if you believe that something is true and will save their lives, and some of the falsehoods that they believe in will destroy their lives, then you have to figure out a way to speak the truth to them in love, even though it might upset them, make them angry or whatever, and figure out a way to do that. Our situation, then, is very much like that of the seeing person in the country of the blind. He knew too much to be clear. It's hard to find the language to use. It's at this point that we need to bring in the imagination in order to look more closely at the topic of language and the problem of meaning. Now, first of all, what do we mean here by imagination? For many people, the first thing that jumps into your mind when you hear the word imagination is fantasy, fanciful things, things that aren't real. Something imagined is something which is not real or true. Now, this is just one really narrow use of the word, as when we talk about imaginative literature. But the word has a much, much broader meaning. And here are some of the definitions. They're on the back of your page as well. Some definitions of imagination from Lewis and some of his mentors and friends. Without imagination, just to introduce these, without imagination, thinking and talking about anything except what is immediately perceivable by our senses would be impossible. So why is that the case? Let's take a look at these definitions. C.S. Lewis said, "Reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the organ of meaning. Imagination producing new metaphors and revivifying old is not the cause of truth, but its condition." Well, this is a very interesting phrase. Imagination is the organ of meaning. And we'll talk about how that works. It's imagination which helps you connect things to something meaningful. George MacDonald says, "The imagination is that faculty which gives form to thought. Not necessarily uttered form, but form capable of being uttered in shape or sound or in any mode upon which the senses can lay hold." Tolkien says, "Imagination is the mental power of image making, forming mental images of things not actually present." And Owen Barfield, this is more of a description than a definition, "The mind is never aware of an idea until the imagination has been at work on the bare material given by the senses. Only by imagination can the world be known." In this book by Ordway on imaginative apologetics, she puts together some of those ideas and says this about imagination. "Imagination is the human faculty that assimilates sensory data into images upon which the intellect can then act. It is the basis of all reason thought, as well as all artistic or what we would call imaginative exercise. Thus, imagination is related to reason, and necessarily so, not related in the way that the two sides of a coin are related to each other, but related in the way that a building's foundation is related to the structure that is built upon it. Reason is dependent on imagination." If somebody starts talking to me about technology and begins using words that I've never heard of before, nothing happens in my brain. I get no image. I have no picture. I have no connection with what they're talking about. It's meaningless. And that's why we're talking about it. The imagination is the organ of meaning. You've got to be able to form some kind of image or connect it with something that you know, in order to begin to understand. And it can help you to know new things, but that's why the words that we use need to be so important. In today's world, so much of the language we use to talk about our faith has no meaning. There are no images in the modern mind to give meaning to the phrase that we are saved by grace. There's that old quip that, you know, if somebody, you tell somebody that Jesus saves and they say to you, at what bank? That's what saves means in there. They don't have another image for that. Or Ordway says that telling the modern skeptic that Jesus loves you makes about as much sense as saying Winston Churchill loves you or King Arthur loves you. Now, what are you talking about? People that, you know, even if he lived, it was a really long time ago. How can that be? That makes no sense. It's meaningless. An idea must mean something before reason can judge whether it is true or false. So how do we make language meaningful? Now, this is a huge topic. It could be a whole separate lecture. But one way to do this is to use figurative language or metaphors. A metaphor can convey something that is true through comparing one thing to something else that can be easily pictured by the person to whom you're speaking. Most often a metaphor is an image of something concrete, which helps supply meaning for an abstract idea. So we teach this in the early grades in school. We teach kids to just come up with really simple metaphors. This bread is as hard as a rock. You know what a rock is? It's a picture of hardness. And so it associates, how hard is that bread? As hard as a rock. Think of all the truth conveyed by Jesus in metaphors. He talked about himself constantly in metaphors. Think about just the statement, I am the good shepherd, made to people who knew well all that the things that a good shepherd does. So much of Jesus' teaching was not in propositions. If you look at the Gospels closely, you'll see that Jesus' teaching was through word pictures in statements or in parables. He's asked questions and he gives really short answers to get people to kind of jolt them, to get them to think. But then he connects things to things that they know, gives them pictures about, I am the vine, you are the branches. They know about vines and branches. What does that mean? And goes on to spell that out. Actually, if you think about it, Jesus himself in his incarnation is the concrete image who helps us see what God is like. Not calling him a metaphor exactly, because he was a person, but he was a concrete image. He is, as it says in Colossians, the visible image of the invisible God. We can see God because Jesus became a man. Jesus was incarnate. Michael Ward, in talking about C.S. Lewis as being a master of communicating through metaphors, did an interesting thing. He went through the book Mere Christianity, and this is a book of you know, apologetics for the most part. But in going through the book, he notes that a brief survey of Mere Christianity supplies the following list of metaphors. Becoming a Christian is like joining a campaign of sabotage, falling at someone's feet or putting yourself in someone's hands, taking on board fuel or food, laying down your rebel arms and surrendering, saying sorry, laying yourself open, turning full speed astern, killing part of yourself, learning to walk or to write, buying God a present with his own money, a drowning man clutching a rescuer's hand, a tin soldier or statue coming alive, waking after a long sleep, getting close to someone or getting infected, emerging from the womb or hatching from an egg, a compass needle swinging to north, a cottage being made into a palace, a field being plowed and re-sown, a horse turning into Pegasus, coming around from anesthetic, coming in out of the wind, going home. All of those metaphors to express what becoming a Christian. And this is in a book of apologetics that he gives us this. He was a master of using images in order to communicate. Try to get back to our
outline.
Just Lewis's friend Austin Ferrer said of Lewis, his real power was not proof, but depiction. There lived in his writings a Christian universe that could be both thought and felt. Lewis was asked to give a talk about religious language, which he began by saying, "In my opinion, there is no specifically religious language." He goes on to explain that he sees three different ways of saying a thing. He calls the first ordinary language. It was very cold. The second is scientific language. It was 13 degrees below zero. The third is poetic language. Ah, bitter chill it was. The owl, for all his feathers, was a cold. The hare limped trembling through the frozen grass, and silent was the flock in woolly fold. Numbed were the beadsman's fingers. This is a stanza from a Keats poem. That's poetic language. Now, these three kinds of language serve different purposes. Scientific is a precise quantitative statement which can be tested, but it says nothing about the experience or the quality of the cold, which both ordinary language and poetic language can do. The poetic language makes the experience of the cold concrete through pictures and adjectives. He points out that the power of poetic language is that it can, quote, convey to us the quality of experiences which we have not had, or perhaps can never have. It uses factors within our experience so that they become pointers to something outside our experience. As two or more roads on a map show us when a town that is off the map must lie. He can't not do it when he's explaining it. He's given us an image at the very end of the quote there. Notice the picture of the map. He goes on to talk about how we express our religious beliefs then. In ordinary language, I believe in God. In theological language, which he calls a form more like we use for scientific matter, in other words, a sort of subset of scientific language, I believe in an incorporeal entity, personal in the sense that it can be the subject and object of love on which all other entities are unilaterally dependent. That's theological language. I believe in God. And about this, he makes this comment, that there's a place for it. Let's get to the right spot here. He says, this is often necessary for purposes of instruction, clarification, controversy, and the like. But it is not the language religion naturally speaks. We are applying precise and therefore abstract terms to what for us is the supreme example of the concrete. And this is one of the great disadvantages under which the Christian apologist labors. Apologetics is controversy. You cannot conduct a controversy in those poetical expressions which alone convey the concrete. You must use terms as definable and univocal as possible. And these are always abstract. And this means that the thing we are really talking about can never appear in the discussion at all. We have to try to prove that God is in circumstances where we are denied every means of conveying who God is. It is faintly parallel to the state of a witness who has to try to convey something so concrete as the known character of a friend under cross-examination. And he goes on to say that speaking in theological language is, in a sense, alien to religion, crippling, omitting nearly all that really matters, yet in spite of everything, sometimes successful. Now, here Lewis is using a very narrow definition of apologetics, controversy, argument. I'm arguing for a broader definition which would include metaphor, poetic language, story, and some other things, and we'll talk more about this, which will help modern skeptics make an imaginative connection with the truth. And I would put forth that Lewis's nonfiction works, actually, of apologetics are not without meaningful illustrations. Like Farrar said, he was a master at depiction, and in right there in his in his works, he has many, many pictures and illustrations to help people see what he's talking about, even when he's writing apologetic works. Lewis then goes on to say about then that poetic language is the spontaneous tendency of religion. Quote, asked what you meant by God, you might say God is love, or the Father of lights, or even underneath are the everlasting arms. Much of what, quote, end quote, much of what God says to us, again, if you think about it, much of what God says to us in his word is poetry. It's a very different kind of religious book because it's narrative and it's poetry. So much of it. God is the supreme poet. There's a wonderful article that just came out in the current issue of Touchstone by a professor at Baylor named David Jeffrey about God as a poet, the poet of heaven and earth. And just let me read just a few lines of what he's got to say here. God speaks poetry. As with a human lover or bridegroom or father, how he speaks, not just what he says, tells us much about who he is. When people less familiar with the Bible think of the voice of God, they often think of it in terms of thou shalt not and similar moral imperatives. When we look more closely at the full canon of Scripture, however, we soon encounter a God who speaks fulsomely and more frequently in poetry, yet not in such a way as to mask the radical truth he utters. I'm skipping to the end of the article. Though some much prefer plain speech and a series of commandments that could be mastered in a system, the God whose voice booms through the prophets in Job, in the vision of John, and in the teaching of Jesus in the Gospels does not so limit himself. Figural speech, riddling aphorisms, paradoxes, melismatic Hebrew parallelism, don't ask me to define that, metaphor, and story upon story are what we get instead. It turns out that in neither testament, when he is disclosing his nature and purpose, does the Lord of heaven and earth always talk like we do. In our own culture's terms, God does not talk like a lawyer, a philosopher, or even a theologian. The fact that God speaks poetically when the issues are most weighty suggests that appreciating his poetry might be an essential element in our knowledge of God. So, God is a poet. And there is a place for that kind of language which conveys the concrete to be used sometimes. This reflects the fact that for the believer, Christianity is much more than a list of propositions. These are important propositions. They need to be communicated. But we need to prepare people to hear them. And it is also ultimately a relationship of trust in a personal God, a truth greater than the words we use to express it, which can best be approached sometimes by poetry. So imaginative apologetics has the task then of making the objective truth of Christianity as clear and meaningful as possible, while also hinting at the fact that there is much more involved. Now, before saying more about how this might be done, I want us to look at the role that the imagination played in Lewis's own conversion. It's interesting that Lewis wrote two books about his conversion. The first is an allegory called Pilgrim's Regress, written just a year after his conversion. The second, Surprised by Joy, was written much later in 1955. And the story is the tale of how both the philosopher in him and the poet in him had to assent to the truth of Christianity. The story is really well told by Alan Jacobs in The Narnian, The Life and Imagination of C.S. Lewis in much more detail than I'm going to be able to give. But as a child, Lewis lived a rich imaginative life, which he saw as having nothing to do with the Anglican church services, which he and his family attended faithfully. He makes this very clear in his allegory, Pilgrim's Regress, that he wrote. The first two chapters, chapter one is called The Rules, and chapter two is called The Island. And these are pictures of these two sides, separate sides of his life. In The Rules, the main character, John, is made to put on uncomfortable, itchy clothes and go to the steward's house to learn about the landlord who lives at the base of a mountain and on top of it is the castle in which the landlord lives. Now, the steward greets John warmly, but then he puts on a large mask with a very angry face, and he reads to him from an enormous list of rules in a sing-songy voice. This is a picture for what Alan Jacobs says about Lewis's early Christianity. It was, quote, a matter of painful and fearful duty. In the second chapter, called The Island, we get a description of John's first experience of longing, or what Lewis came to call joy, aroused initially by the beauty he saw in the natural world. The best way is just to read a clip of this to you. And now I dreamed that John went out one morning and tried to play in the road and to forget his troubles. But the rules kept coming back into his head so that he could not make much of it. However, he went on, always a few yards further, till suddenly he looked up and saw that he was so far away from home that he was in a part of the road he had never seen before. Then came the sound of a musical instrument. From behind, it seemed, very sweet and very short, as if it were plucking of a string or one note of a bell, and after it a full, clear voice. And it sounded so high and strange that he thought it was very far away, further than a star. The voice said, "Come." Then John saw that there was a stone wall beside the road in that part. But it had a window. There was no glass in the window and no bars. It was just a square hole in the wall. Through it, he saw a green wood full of primroses. There came to him from beyond the wood a sweetness and a pang so piercing that instantly he forgot his father's house and his mother and the fear of the landlord and the burden of the rules. All the furniture of his mind was taken away. A moment later, he found that he was sobbing and the sun had gone in. And what it was that had happened to him, he could not quite remember, nor whether it had happened in this wood or in the other wood when he was a child. It seemed to him that a mist which hung at the far end of the wood had parted for a moment, and through the rift he had seen a calm sea, and in the sea an island where the smooth turf sloped down unbroken to the bays. And out of thickets peeped pale, small-breasted oreads, wise like gods, unconscious of themselves like beasts, and tall enchanters, bearded to their feet, sat in green chairs among the forests. But even while he pictured these things, he knew, with one part of his mind, that they were not like the things he had seen. Nay, that what had befallen him was not seeing at all. But he was too young to heed the distinction, and too empty, now that the unbounded sweetness passed away, not to seize greedily whatever it had left him. Yet he had no inclination yet to go into the wood, and presently he went home with a sad excitement upon him, repeating to himself 1,000 times, "I know now what I want." The first time that he said it, he was aware that it was not entirely true. But before he went to bed, he was believing it. It's a picture of his first experience of joy. And in his other book, Surprised by Joy, he describes his early imaginative life like this and gives us a definition of what he means by this term joy. It is that of an unsatisfied desire, which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. I call it joy, which is here a technical term and must be sharply distinguished from both happiness, note, and from pleasure. Joy, in my sense, has indeed one characteristic and one only in common with them: the fact that anyone who has experienced it will want it again. Apart from that, and considered only in its quality, that might almost equally well be called a particular kind of unhappiness or grief. But then it is a kind we want. I doubt whether anyone who has tasted it would ever, if both were in his power, exchange it for all the pleasures in the world. But then joy is never in our power, and pleasure often is. Mm-hmm. Other places he calls this the unconsolable longing. We'll talk a little bit more about it as we go along too. A little bit. At the same point in his mid-teens, in his mid-teens, for a variety of reasons, which included the great burden of his religious duties and his love for pagan myths, he gave up Christianity and declared himself an atheist. And he described it, quote, "Little by little, with fluctuations I cannot now trace, I became apostate, dropping my faith with no sense of loss, but with the greatest relief." He continued in the next years to seek experiences of joy in his reading and found much that spoke to him in Norse mythology, something he called a sense of northernness or the horns of Elfland from a poem by Tennyson. Later, skipping forward in his life to his undergraduate years at Oxford, Lewis decided to turn away from literature to study philosophy. And Jacobs points out here that Lewis felt the need to disenchant himself, believing that he was being misled by his imagination. And he was going to put this behind him. And he writes, quote, "Now what, I asked myself, were all my delectable mountains and western gardens, but sheer fantasies? With the confidence of a boy, I decided I had done with all that. No more Avalon, no more Hesperides. I was never going to be taken in again." If you're a Lewis reader, you recognize that line. These words, which he put into the mouths of dwarves and other skeptics in his fiction, turn out to be autobiographical. I was never going to be taken in again. So he turned to philosophy. He chose to be a realist. And through his philosophical studies, Lewis adopted a philosophy he called Stoical Monism, which is, he could hardly explain, but it's a belief in the existence of the universe. He was very comforted by the fact that something rather than nothing existed. He believed in the universe. He says that this gave him a great sense of peace. And at this point, he labeled joy as aesthetic experience. And he said it was very valuable, but he seldom experienced it. Now, many of the friends that Lewis made at Oxford, both as a student and later as a tutor, were Christians or theists. And one of these, Owen Barfield, began to poke holes in Lewis's realism. He said he had no grounds for calling aesthetic experience valuable, since for the realist, all thought beyond what can be known by the senses is purely a subjective event, just a personal feeling. So after some thought and being unwilling to give up entirely what he felt he had gained through his imaginative life, Lewis became next an idealist. I sort of listed this process here. An idealist. Following the thinking of Hegel, he accepted a belief in a cosmic mind, or what he called the absolute, with a capital A, an impersonal something behind the sensuous curtain. He says that this came close to a religious belief, but that it was a religion which cost nothing, in which there was nothing to fear, nothing to obey. When he finished his undergraduate degree, there were no jobs available to him in the philosophy department, so he decided to do a year of English literature so that he would have another something in his toolbox to find a job. Jacobs comments here that by doing this, Lewis was flirting with delight. Quote, opening himself up to the very world of literary experiences that philosophically he was in the process of rejecting. And as he got into his literary studies, he actually says this, "All the books were beginning to turn against me. Indeed, I must have been as blind as a bat not to have seen long before the ludicrous contradiction between my theory of life and my actual experiences as a reader." And at this point, he recalls the effect that reading his first George MacDonald novel when he was a teenager had on him. Now, this was back when he was basically an atheist before he was in university in his teens. He had bought the novel Fantasties at a train station. And he says, looking back on that, it had done more to me than any, he had done more to me than any other writer. Now I'm getting honest about this. And on reading the novel by MacDonald for the first time, he says, it was as though the voice which had called me from the world's end was now speaking at my side. Compared to this, his other experiences of joy had left the world a desert. Quote, but now I saw the bright shadow coming out of the book into the real world and resting there, transforming all common things. That night, my imagination was, in a certain sense, baptized. The rest of me, not unnaturally, took longer, like another decade. But he considered that the baptism of his imagination, a really different experience of this desire, this longing, this joy. Now, in his lit studies, back to the lit studies that he was doing, he found himself feeding on the writings of Christians and religious writers such as Spencer and Milton and George Herbert, while he found the work of those with whom he was more aligned philosophically, quote, a little thin, what as boys we called tinny. After his studies, he got a job as a tutor and joined Oxford English faculty. Two other English tutors became his friends and play a very big part in his story, Hugo Dyson and J.R.R. Tolkien. He tried to hold on to his absolute idealism, but now several things conspire to move him toward theism. He describes the sense that he is being stalked or hunted, and he frames the story in the language of a chess match in Surprised by Joy, Checkmate. Different chapters have names from chess here. And he has the foolish idea that he thinks he can maybe win. Two moves which the adversary, as he calls God, makes are worth noting. One captures his imagination. He rereads a book and finds himself overwhelmed by the old experience of longing or joy. The other captures his intellect. He reads an essay about two distinct activities of the mind, which enables him to see his experience of joy, his experiences of joy for what they are. He sees for the first time that the images and sensations are pointers to something beyond themselves. If you know his own essay, this that he wrote later about this, he wrote an essay called Meditation in a Tool Shed, where he talks about the difference between contemplation and enjoyment, thinking about the thinking or enjoying the thing outside of yourself. And now he's realizing something about his experiences of joy for the very first time that is kind of really opens his mind. he says, as the dry bones shook and came together in that dreadful valley of Ezekiel's, so now a philosophical theorem, cerebrally entertained, began to stir and heave and throw up its grave clothes and stood upright and became a living presence. I was to be allowed to play at philosophy no longer. And he, you must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling, whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him who I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. Now, this was not a conversion to Christianity, he goes on quickly to point out. It must be understood that that conversion recorded in the last chapter was only to theism, pure and simple, not to Christianity. I knew nothing yet about the incarnation. He's accepted a belief in a personal God who he believes has every right to make demands of him. And he says this, which is quite interesting. No slightest hint was vouchsafed me that there ever had been or ever would be any connection between God and joy. If anything, it was the reverse. I had hoped that the heart of reality might be of such a kind that we could best symbolize it as a place. Instead, I found it to be a person. For all I knew, the total rejection of what I called joy might be one of the demands, might be the very first demand he would make upon me. There was no strain of music from within, no smell of eternal orchards at the threshold when I was dragged through the doorway. No kind of desire was present at all. So this was his conversion to theism. As he sought to learn more about the God he had acknowledged, he tried to find a way to reconcile the dying God of the pagan myths that he loved and was really drawn to with Christianity. And he wrestled with two questions. What is myth? And what is the relation of myth and its story of the dying God to Christianity? And at this point, he had a really, really key conversation with Tolkien and Dyson one night taking a walk on the grounds of his college in September 1931. And this was the turning point which led to the final step, his conversion to Christianity. Lewis describes this turning point in a letter that he wrote to his lifelong friend, Arthur Greaves. And this puts well what it is that they said to him and what finally he came to realize. Now, what Dyson and Tolkien showed me was this, that if I met the idea of sacrifice in a pagan story, I didn't mind it at all. And again, that if I met the idea of God sacrificing himself to himself, I liked it very much and was mysteriously moved by it. Again, that the idea of the dying and reviving God, Balder, Adonis, Bacchus, similarly moved me, provided I met it anywhere except in the Gospels. The reason was that in pagan stories, I was prepared to feel the myth as profound and suggestive of meanings beyond my grasp, even though I could not say in cold prose what it meant. Now, the story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with the tremendous difference that it really happened. And one must be content to accept it in the same way, remembering that it is God's myth, where the others are men's myths, i.e., the pagan stories are God expressing himself through the minds of poets, using such images as he found there, while Christianity is God expressing himself through real things. A week later, Lewis took the final step. He was riding in the sidecar of his brother's motorcycle, and he describes this briefly, describes this in and Surprised by Joy. He says, as I drew near the conclusion, I felt a resistance almost as strong as my previous resistance to theism, as strong but shorter-lived, for I understood it better. Every step I had taken, from the absolute to spirit and from spirit to God, had been a step toward the more concrete, the more imminent, the more compulsive. At each step, one had less chance to call one's soul one's own. To accept the incarnation was a further step in the same direction. It brings God nearer, or near in a new way. And this I found was something I had not wanted. I was driven to Whipsnade one sunny morning. When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did. Yet I had not exactly spent the trip journey in thought, nor in great emotion. Emotional is perhaps the last word we can apply to some of the most important events. It was more like When a man, after long sleep, still lying motionless in bed, becomes aware that he is now awake. Notice that he can only describe this as a metaphor. He can't really talk about what happened. And it's one of the metaphors that was in that list from before. I don't know that we really need it anymore. No, I don't think we need to go back to that. I just wanted to kind of go back to where we started with the end of Pilgrim's Regress. At the end of Pilgrim's Regress, we're given an allegorical picture of Lewis's conversion in which the two sides, the rules and the island, come together. John's long journey in this book, a really interesting story with a lot of, this is an annotated version, which is quite helpful, but it's quite an interesting read. But he's come to the end of this long journey through all the different philosophies and all the different people that he got pulled one side or another of. And he's back to where he started from. He's on a beach looking across the water at what he supposes to be the western end of the world. And across the water, he sees the island. Let me just read a short bit. A guide appears, and John asks, "Pray, do we take ship from here?" But the guide shook his head. And he asked them to look at the island again, especially to consider the shape of the crags or the castle, for they could not see which at that distance, to which it rose at its highest point. "I see," said John presently. "What do you see?" said the guide. "They are the very same shape as the summit of the eastern mountain, which we called the Landlord's Castle, as we saw it from Puritania." "They are not only the same shape, they are the same." "How can that be?" said John with a sinking heart. "For those mountains were in the extreme east, and we've been traveling west ever since we left home." "But the world is round," said the guide, "and you have come nearly round it. The island is the mountains. And if you will, the island is the other side of the mountains, and not in truth an island at all." So the two worlds come together because the island is on the back of the mountain where the landlord lives. And that sort of resolves his story. But let me just briefly then conclude by saying, what do we learn from Lewis's conversion story about imaginative apologetics? We've looked at the relationship between language and imagination. And I'd like to say just a little bit, it has to be a very little bit, about the role of imaginative literature in apologetics. Lewis is perhaps unusual in the huge part that imaginative literature played in his life. Yet there's something in human nature that responds to narrative, to story. We are all God's creatures, whether we acknowledge it or not. Thus, we are part of a narrative of which God is the author. We search for meaning in our lives precisely because we were made to play a part in a story. In doing apologetics, we need to hold on to the truth that human nature is unchanging. That as different as these moderns may think they are from us, or think they've made themselves into something different, as much as one may try to convince himself that there's nothing outside of himself which defines who he is, the fact remains that he is a creature made in God's image. Human nature is unchanging. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon shows so clearly that life without this understanding is meaningless, and that the very cry that you hear throughout Ecclesiastes, "everything is meaningless," speaks to the fact, speaks to the longing for meaning and the fact that there must be more than what we find under the sun. Why would we call it meaningless if there wasn't something that had meaning? In Ecclesiastes 3:10-11, we find these probably familiar verses. I have seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Isn't that interesting? What's the burden that God has laid on men? Beauty and the desire for permanence and meaning and something more than the cold, hard facts of materialism are a burden if man is left to himself to figure out the meaning of life. Simply. Where reasoned argument for the truth about God may fall flat, imaginative literature, stories, which are factual, but which are true. And there is a difference Lewis talks about between fact and truth. Sorry, there's something after me here. stories which are true can serve as pointers to the ultimate truth, that we are part of a story that gives meaning to our lives. Here's how Lewis explains this phenomenon in his wonderful sermon, The Weight of Glory. Just a paragraph from that sermon. Lewis says, "The books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them. It came only through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshippers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited." Lewis wrote stories, fiction, for two reasons. Lewis points out that this longing is an indication that we are not merely material beings, that there is something more. Lewis wrote stories, fiction, for two reasons. He calls the two reasons, in an essay that he wrote, the author's reason and the man's reason. As an author, he loved stories, and he had pictures in his imagination which he had to come out and he had to write. He felt compelled to turn them into stories. But as a man, and as a Christian man, he wrote stories to help people envision a Christian view of reality. Stephen Smith, a theologian, this is the final quote, in an essay that he wrote called Awakening from the Enchantment of Worldliness, the Chronicles of Narnia as Pre-Apologetics, says this. What Lewis is doing, what is Lewis doing in these stories? Let me suggest a word, pre-apologetics. As we speak of creating a disposition to hear the gospel as pre-evangelism, we can speak of creating a predisposition to believe the truth of the Christian vision and to doubt the alternatives as pre-apologetics. Because it attempts to change the reader's vision or imagination, to give them new assumptions about what is or can be true, pre-apologetics is done primarily through story, through stories that undermine the secular story and make believable the Christian story. The story does what no theorem can do, Lewis wrote. A story may not be like real life in the superficial sense, but it sets before us an image of what reality may well be like at some more central region. I would differ from Smith in calling this pre-apologetics. I'm trying to call for a broader definition of this work of cultivating an environment in which belief is both reasonable and meaningful. But story plays a key role in imaginative apologetics, in this expanded view of cultivating this kind of environment. And I will stop there. Mm-hmm. Oh, Drew, it's a big topic. So, you're free to leave if you need to. But if you'd like to stay and talk about any of these things, ask questions or make comments, you may. You're dismissed. I'm not a teacher anymore, Tom. Yes.
Well, for those of us who are not up on the Norse mythology, can you describe a little bit of Balder?
No, I can't. I'm not up on Norse mythology. Okay. I'm sorry. I just know that he was, he didn't know much about it, but he just, it was in a line of poetry that he read. How does it go?
Balder
is dead. Is dead. Balder the beautiful is dead. And that was one of those lines that just the sound of it brought that longing for something he knew not what into his brain. But it's a dying god kind of story. And I'm sorry, I'm not up on Norse mythology.
I think we're all missing something there then, right?
I'm not so sure.
There's actually a version of the story that I've heard.
Okay.
That Balder is one of the sons of Odin. He's kind of the youngest son, and he is beautiful. Odin's wife, Balder's mother, hears from an oracle or something that Balder is going to die young, like in the prime of his life. Mm-hmm. And because she loves him so much, she figures, well, this can't happen. So she goes to every living thing in creation and asks them not to harm her son. Oh. Because he is so beautiful and so well-loved, all of them agree. Mm-hmm. And then Loki, the trickster, is jealous that Balder's getting all of this attention and overhears Balder's mother tell, like, one of the other gods that she talked to everything in creation except this little mistletoe plant.
Because
it was mistletoe, it wasn't really a problem. So Loki goes, finds the mistletoe, turns it into an arrow, and because everything in creation had promised not to harm Balder, all the gods are, like, throwing stuff at him, and it's just bouncing right off because, like, wood and stone and, like, hot water and fire had agreed not to harm him. And Loki tricks one of the gods into throwing the mistletoe at him, and he dies.
Okay. Well, there you have it. I did actually read a summary of that. It just wasn't still in my brain. So, what else? Yes?
You had a compiled list of all these metaphors from a book. Where did you get that?
They all came out of Mere Christiani, but they... Michael Ward, I don't know if he's the guy that wrote Planet Narnia, and he's quite a scholar on Lewis, but he wrote this essay called, he wrote an essay, which I don't have, that's in a collection, called The Good Serves the Better and Both the Best, C.S. Lewis on Imagination and Reason in Apologetics. And it's in a book called Imaginative Apologetics, Theology, Philosophy, and the Catholic Tradition. I actually put together a list of about 15 resources on essays by Lewis and other books and other things. I mean, this thing grew and grew and grew. I mean, it was great fun to study for. It was just a little hard to decide how to fit it into one lecture, almost.
What was the book called? Like, if we wanted to try
if you wanted to find
list.
That book, the book itself is Imaginative Apologetics, Theology, Philosophy, and the Catholic Tradition. It's put out by Baker Academic. It's edited by Andrew Davison. You could probably, I think if you probably Google Michael Ward, you might. Yes, she quoted a couple of things from that essay, which sounds like it's a good one.
Could you tell me the name of the book by Holly Ordway?
Yes, this is Apologetics and the Christian Imagination. And this is her book, Holly Ordway. Yeah, she tells her own story. It's somewhat
that she was an atheist who loved the Narnia books and didn't really, I've read at least three different examples of this happening where people just didn't make the connection. They just thought they were great stories. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly there was this kind of aha moment. Oh, that's what's going on. But it gave a real image of Aslan, presents a real image of what, dying for Edmund. That's a picture that just connected, connects with people. But you should never explain that to children. You just put the images in their heads. Yes?
I'm really intrigued by your idea that Matt's word is really important in how we communicate, and it's important in communicating. I'd say kind of everything we say about God is in some sense magical, because we're talking about a God who is literally indescribable. I wonder if you have any insight in how we ensure that both we and people we talk to don't interpret how we ensure people do interpret the metaphor as magical rather than as concrete fact, because it seems like some of the problem with communication with God is that people take the metaphor rather the thing that's been important that we think those are saying they're not.
And so there's got to be this quote that I couldn't fit in, where it's got to be done together with. I mean, if you read Lewis's, I think Lewis does a fabulous job, but this is in the problem of me. Where there's so many images and so many examples and things, but he's also making some very clear, he's presenting some clear, you've got to integrate, she calls it an integrated approach to defending the faith. But what you're doing is you're putting this together with some reason, some argument, some reason, defense of some of the truths of Christianity. But it's just that it's got to be the whole thing. It's got to be winning the trust of the person. So it's not something that you can just do quick. I was in a club when I was in high school, and we memorized to teach us the Christians. It was hard. It was a horrible experience. It took a long time before I could actually go into the breed that got me out of this way of thinking, because we had to memorize little speeches to give to people at school that to try to witness, to present Christianity to, and we practiced this at the club. You've probably seen some of these things. You wear a question mark. Somebody says, what's that question mark you're wearing? It's not a question mark. It's an upside down fish hook. I was hoping you'd like. And then I can't remember the rest of the speech. there are about three or four, a little paragraph that presents the gospel. It's totally out of context. It's totally, what's somebody supposed to do with that? Not even in the context of developing a relationship, or at least demonstrating in some way that you care about the person. And Chafer was so good at answering questions, was communicating his care for the person's question. And yet, still, being very straightforward. Yeah.
It seems to me there's two different things you've been talking about. Well, many things, but two of the things. One of which is just how to communicate, how to speak to a person in front of you in a way that is not cliche, or a way that captures their imagination. Lewis is talking about figuring out how to communicate something that I hold to be true, but not speaking in theological language, but in either the vernacular or some understandable way, or some metaphor that grabs their imagination. Mm-hmm. But then there's also what he was describing somewhere in your talk about, in every field, the best example of work in that field was done by a Christian. In other words, going out, writing good novels, making films that aren't necessarily explicitly
Right. So it's this got to be a
communal
project.
It's like a culture-wide effort.
This has got to be a culture-wide effort. And I think that's becoming clearer and clearer in the day with all kinds of things that are being written about us, you know, being a visible community of people that do all kinds of different things that make people ask questions, first of all, that are attractive, that work, just stir questions, so that, you know, everybody can do some different parts of this project, really. Yes.
Okay, well, one observation that occurs to me is that so many pastors and seminary do not get a chance to use everyday language to discuss theological concepts. Mm-hmm. They read big, thick tomes and respond in thick words to their possibly thick professors. Yet the pastor that I once had, who is acknowledged by everybody to be one of the best writers of sermons, spent 5 years working as a newspaper. And so he knows how to use concrete language and tell a story. And then that reminds me that for a different pastor, at another point, this pastor invited me to write a prayer to be said before the congregation on Christmas Sunday. And so I decided to use some different words in it from the usual Christmas words. And this pastor got really upset with me. Instead of mentioning Jesus being laid in a manger,